This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today, a panel discussion on what to expect of U.S.-China relations during the Biden administration, as well as the long history between the two nations and where we go from here. The United States and China are the two largest economies in the world, with China set to eclipse the U.S. economy in size within a decade. But economic issues are only the first in a long list of collaborations and contentions between the U.S. and China. Disagreements over international norms, geopolitical control, intellectual property, and national sovereignty have regularly set China and the U.S. at odds on the world stage. Additionally, Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, frequently blamed China for the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, a sentiment that led to a demonstrable increase in anti-Asian racism in the United States. In November, President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping discussed several critical issues between the two nations during a 3.5-hour virtual summit. Xi specifically warned that supporting Taiwanese independence would be playing with fire and criticized the U.S. moves to create political blocs in the Pacific region. Biden spoke in support of guardrails to prevent future disagreements from rising to outright conflict. The two world leaders also plan to hold future nuclear arms talks, even as both countries prepare to reinforce their nuclear arsenals. Today's panel dig into the complexities of U.S.-China relations and discuss where they can go from here. The panelists include Stephen Ohm, Associate Professor of Political Science at the National Sun Yat-sen University, and Yang-Chi Tong, Professor of Political Science at the University of Utah. Moderating today's discussion is Ann Lopez, forum host for the Hinckley Institute. This forum was put on in partnership with the University of Utah's Asia Center. This forum was recorded on March 1, 2021. First, Professor Yang-Chi Tong will give a short presentation on the history between the U.S. and China. Here is Yang-Chi Tong.
So first, I will just talk very, very briefly about the history of China-U.S. relations. Well, I'm Professor Ong. If you feel that you have something, some comments to make, that's just free to join in.
Go ahead first.
Very briefly, if we look at the important point in the history, in fact, it's not just China-U.S. relations, it's PRC-U.S. relations. So PRC was founded in 1949. So we count 1950s and 1960s. The relations between China and the United States, we can categorize it as hostility. They saw each other as enemies. And then things started to change in the 70s. The turning point probably is in 1972 when President Nixon visited China. But a visit is just a visit. It didn't change the nature of the relations, but we call that the entire 70s, PRC and the United States has been in pretty warm relations, but we cannot call it very close, but kind of warmer than in the 50s and 60s. Another point in this history was in 1979. When the PRC and the United States established formal diplomatic relations with each other. So since 1979, the two countries started very normal relations, official and normal relations. And then in the 1980s, I call it a China dream for the United States, because after they established formal diplomatic relations, United States really pinned a lot of hope on China to become a market economy, to become a democracy, and this is that. This is a dream that United States has had for all those years in the past hundreds of years. I call this China dream. Then another point, important event happened in 1989. that's the Tiananmen protest movement or Tiananmen pro-democracy movement, which was cracked down by the Chinese regime. And then that led to a prolonged period of cold, I cannot say cold war, but it is very cold. So for all these years, United States, in the 1990s, United States has been trying to manage a broken dream. Americans are so disappointed. We thought China would become a democracy, a market economy, and it didn't happen. So we had to manage this broken dream, and the United States tried to think of anything possible to punish China for this broken dream. For example, the most favored nation status, the debate over that, and other sanctions that the United States could think of. Then in the 2000s, when China continued to develop its economy and Chinese power are on the rise, then the major task for the United States is to deal with a rising China. This is a serious challenge. It's very different from the past. Well, enemies or kind of a friends or partners, this and that. And now we are going to deal with a rising China. The important events since 2000s, I just put it very bravely, well, even though there are many, many things happened in the past 20 years, is after President Trump became the president, and he launched this trade war with China in 2018. But also before this trade war actually was over is the COVID-19 pandemic crisis. And these two events under President Trump actually became make the relations between two countries went down to the bottom. Okay, so this is a very, very brave history of US-China relations.
Well, could I just add one point to your fine presentation, Uncle? Uh-huh. I would like to mention that in 1999, United States NATO led NATO and the tragedy of bombing the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. Under President Clinton, that was in my mind one of the lowest points, perhaps the lowest, towards the end of the last millennia in the U.S.-China relations. So that's just one small data point that I would like to contribute to your otherwise wonderful presentation, and thank you.
It's a very good point. And also I would like to add to your point is this air collision in South China Sea.
Oh, exactly.
That's another event that actually, make the relations just went to the bottom. Well, after that, they tried to come back also during the Obama period, but then... Yes. Then it is the most recent happenings.
Absolutely.
Very bravely, my comments about why the relations between two countries are like the same, like this. It is the structural change in the world order. And because first it is the rising of China. And as a new power, and the United States as an existing power facing this challenge. So this is inevitable, this structural friction and structural change in the world order that generated this bad relationship between the two countries. And now in the United States, there is bipartisan consensus on tough policies toward China. This is not just Republicans or Democrats, it's bipartisan consensus. China is, well, they may not put enemy. Some, I think Republicans would say this is enemy, and Biden group probably wouldn't use this word, but basically all agree we need to have tough policies toward China. The problem, I think, is the United States has never dealt with a strong rising China since the 18th century. For all these years, China was a weak, backward, even though culturally very different country. But it is a weak country, but not anymore now, especially since 2000. So China and the United States has never dealt with a strong and rising China. So this is very frustrating, I think, for the United States. And this frustration led to hate rhetoric. All these things we heard from Congress, from White House, from all over the United States. What I heard, I would characterize as hate rhetoric. For example, I don't remember what the name of that senator who said the Chinese have 5,000 years of just cheating and stealing or something like that, right? I don't really remember her name. But anyway, so this kind of hate rhetoric has been there. And all this creations of Chinese virus and other things. Okay, so this is my looking at the current situation. Then I would think looking at Biden's administration, President Biden is unlikely to depart very far from President Trump's China policy. Why? Because as I said, the structural change is beyond any individual's will or individual capability. It's not just one politician likes or dislikes something, because this structural change, just the rising power and existing power is there. The conflict is there, that nobody can avoid that. And also because there is bipartisan consensus on China as a rival, a serious rival, and also for domestic audience. I don't think Biden could really change much of the US-China policy. He has to please domestic audience there. However, I would think that President Biden will take a softer, but this softer basically compares with Trump's approach, will take a softer approach, such as calling the issue with China is extreme competition, not conflict, not the enemy, but extreme competition. So this is softer than the word that President Trump used. And also he suspended several policies targeting Chinese companies, such as WeChat and TikTok. So these moves showed some softer approach, but it doesn't mean that the United States would not take a tough position vis-a-vis China. I think I'll just stop here and see Professor Ong.
Okay, thank you. What I would like to add is that it seems to me I'm in mostly in agreement with you, Professor Dong, that these structural issues in which we see a rising and more confident China taking on a greater role, especially in economic activities, forging ties with various developing nations, especially African nations, this rising China tries to displace the current leading power, which is the United States. This structural conflict, I think for the most part, I would agree with you. My only squeamish and slight reservation is that I think due to the economic pressure from business leaders, business executives, and entrepreneurs in the United States, the sort of activities and sanctions and pronouncements that the Biden White House will have to make, especially when it comes to abusive trade practices, theft of intellectual properties and intellectual property violations by the PRC, I think there's tremendous pressure on the current administration to do and to crack down on Chinese abuses. So this structural explanation that you give, I wholeheartedly endorse. And let me just take one or two steps back in the sense that if we look at the major headlines, right, the preoccupations of the leadership in Beijing, whether it is in Xinjiang province, the new security law in Hong Kong and here in Taiwan. And I would say the PRC's military activity in South China Sea, all of these major headlines, in my mind, if we step back and look at these developments beyond People's Republic of China or the Republic of China, I would say these are imperial headaches and imperial legacy from the last dynasty that the Qing rulers have bequeathed to Republican China and now People's Republic of China. So those are my few points that I would like to offer on the discussion table, so to speak.
That was Steve On, Associate Professor of Political Science at the National Sun Yat-sen University. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today, we are airing a panel discussion on U.S.-China relations in the Biden era. Here is your moderator, Ann Lopez.
That's great. Wonderful. Thank you, Professor Tong, for that presentation. You covered a lot of what we want to talk about, but I think we want to get into a little bit of the specifics as well on things that you mentioned. We talked a lot about economy, a lot about how China is rising. There's a lot of competition. What specifically is China doing in the last 30 to 40 years to get such positive economic results?
About China's economic successful or relatively successful economic development, then there is this question about China model. But I don't want to spend too much China's model, but I think the one of the crucial component of this China model is state-led development. It's not really, they encourage market to work, but it is under the state direction. I want to say that. It is not a planned economy. It's very different. The state didn't really plan the economy, but the state actually directed the development and put a lot of resources into this economic development. And as the state has control all these resources of the country, so China's development, developed very fast in the past 30, 40 years. And also China adopted pretty, effective strategy like to increase the export to the world and make the Chinese product competitive in the world. Now China is the number one trading power in the world, both in terms of export and in terms of import. So I think China adopted the right strategy and model. And there are other factors that many scholars suggested, like human resources, labor cost was cheaper and well educated. But China is running out of this surplus labor, and people basically predicted that in the next 10 years, China will facing labor shortage. But until now, I think these are the factors that contributed to China's economic growth.
Awesome, thank you. Okay, Professor, as always, if you have something to add, just go ahead and bump right.
Well, let me just add, after the death of Mao Zedong, and, when Deng Xiaoping ushered in these reforms, I mean, we should look back in the, shall we say, early 70s. Reforms were taking place even during Mao's lifetime, but they were simply overruled by Chairman Mao during his lifetime. And historically speaking, development phase and reform of China, this vast continental state, had there were some movements even during the late Qing dynasty, I would say, the Qing Empire. But I would pick out four major sequences. First, there's the land reform and moving from an agricultural based economy more to a manufacturing base. And that would be the second phase, so to speak. And then the third is foreign direct investment, investments from business executives here in Taiwan and around the world, especially Japan, South Korea, US, and eventually Europe, I suppose. Investing in mainland, and obviously in the current phase, I would point out indigenous and local inventions, or at least joint enterprises. So these are four major sequences have enabled China to develop and become the world's second largest economy. And by some measure, I would say, I mean, it's very difficult to have too much confidence in the numbers coming out from Beijing. But some studies have suggested that China is already the world's largest economy, or at least within the next 5, maybe 7 years, will become definitely the largest economy. So I would pick out a land reform, a shift to a manufacturer, export-based economy, and foreign direct investment, and now a local invention and a homegrown discovery. So I would like to add these points. Thank you.
Yeah, that's great. I think it's also interesting to look at China in regard to multilateral organizations. You know, the U.S. has had such a strong input in modern history on, you know, things like the World Bank, economic multilateral organizations. And now we're seeing the rise of, you know, the Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank. You know, it's headquartered in Beijing. Its focus is to, you know, improve the economy of Asian countries. I just wonder how is the U.S. going to have to adapt from not only not being on top, but also not, we're going to have to get used to not being that leader or having at least a significant say in multilateral organizations.
Go first, Professor Tong.
Oh, this is, I think this move, like the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank thing is China's new moves in the last decade. And this also reflects China's ambition to be more active, or more take a more leading role in world affairs, especially in this economic affairs, probably not in politics, But in terms of development, China is willing to take more of a leading role here, I mean, by establishing this bank. I know United States tried to persuade other countries not to join this bank, but didn't work very well. Most of the European countries decided to join the bank. I think China, United States is still, as I pointed out earlier, United States didn't know how to deal with a strong China. So United States is still learning to deal with these moves by China. I don't have good suggestions for American government, but I just believe American government will learn. Well, after years of experiment or try or just see, eventually will find a way to cope with China's, this rising China.
Well, let me add that as developing nations around the world have more experience at the receiving end of the CCP's leadership and their practices, I think these developing nations and even European and developed nations, they will realize that the word of the CCP leadership may not be honored, and that most often that they are falling into some sort of trap, whether it's the debt trap or diplomatic trap or whatever trap. For example, here in the Southeast Asia area, the Philippines, they have signed all of these wonderful agreements, but little of the promises have been materialized. And so I think once we look beyond the fanfare and the publicity generated by these headline-grabbing stories, we will find, and as developing nations have found, that signing these contracts, they may not be getting what they have been promised. And specifically, just looking at, I would say, how the handover or the retrocession of sovereignty from British, sovereignty in Hong Kong from Britain back to Beijing, I mean, 50 years have not elapsed. And look at how much autonomy and or relative autonomy and freedom have eroded in Hong Kong already. So I would say once more developing nations have experienced this sort of extreme and aggressive diplomacy, so-called wolf warrior, I think that's the term, wolf warrior diplomacy, from Beijing, they will realize that it's a rather bad bargain that they have struck. And in my mind, they would turn to Washington and other European, other Western capital for assistance as opposed to relying upon Beijing.
Yeah, great. Professor An, you mentioned Hong Kong and the autonomy there that they have. I mean, you're in Taiwan. For audience doesn't know, Professor An is joining us from Taiwan. It's almost 3 a.m. there, so we're really grateful to have him here. But he has, you know, a special experience being in Taiwan. I wonder if you can give us a little bit of insight on what the U.S.'s role in relations with democracies that have some autonomy from China. You know, I remember the infamous call that Trump made to Taiwan at the beginning of his administration and that sort of the backlash there. So what is the U.S., how do we work with those democracies?
Well, I think United States, whoever's in charge in the White House, the support that Washington and the State Department in Foggy Bottom, Washington, D.C., can offer to democracy here in Taiwan or South Korea or Japan, it's very, very important. And there's no more indispensable, there's no greater ally and friend then the United States for Taiwan, Japan, and South Korea. So I would say without United States military, diplomatic, economic, and all kinds of assistance and support over the years, many of these nations here in Asia, thriving democracies, I would say they would feel threatened. And let me just add briefly that my background, my bachelor's degree is in French from University of California. And I also have a master's degree in French from New York University. But I do have a master's degree in foreign affairs and a PhD from University of California. And I'm an American expatriate from San Francisco, teaching here in National Sun Yat-sen. And let me give a brief shout out to Wen Jiao, Ursuline University of Languages, where I teach as an adjunct one course per semester. So that's a little bit of my background. Thank you.
That's wonderful, thanks. We just had an audience question come in. I think I'll include these as we go because it's very relevant. Barry asks, after the actions in Hong Kong, what can we expect when looking at the future policy of US and Taiwan in relationship to mainland China? And I think I'll just add to that. In this past week, we saw Beijing move to impose more restrictions on Hong Kong in their elections, just in an effort to root out, you know, politicians that they consider disloyal. What does that mean for Hong Kong? What does that mean for US policy?
Would you like to go, Professor Tong? Would you like to take that up, Professor Tong?
with regard to Hong Kong, I think it's a very complicated issue because we all know in 2019, almost the whole year, the students in Hong Kong has been protesting and involve a lot of violence there. The thing is, then after that, China decided to take a very tough measure against all these popular protests. That's my understanding. And they eventually passed this national security law and started to arrest some of the leaders and activists during those protests movement. I think China has tightened its grip on Hong Kong. But many in China would believe that if you don't do it, then basically you're going to lose Hong Kong. I mean, China is going to lose Hong Kong. And Hong Kong used to be a very important joining point between mainland China and the world. China received a lot of investment money from Hong Kong, but and Hong Kong now is losing its position as a financial center in Asia. So I think that basically explains some of China's moves. You like it or not, but that's the rationale behind China's decisions. I don't think whatever United States does will help. I mean, for example, you can sanction certain leaders or frozen their bank account or something like that, or you list these people cannot visit the United States. That's not going to improve situation in Hong Kong. And also, I think Great Britain also issued the policy saying they can take a lot of immigrants from Hong Kong, and China had some countermeasures against that. But anyway, so I don't think all these things will help to improve Hong Kong's situation. Okay.
Well, I would say having a free-willing, free-dealing Hong Kong, as Hong Kong was during British colonial time and in the early years after the Hanover in 1997. This sort of autonomy. I think the leadership in Beijing cannot tolerate a counterpoint or rival power base. So in my mind, it's a very brutal way to kill the goose that lays the golden egg. And if Hong Kong's finance and economic nosedive, and which this the economic benefit goes to Taiwan and Singapore, all the rich clients, all the rich Hong Kongers, they have fled and either relocated here to Taiwan or take their money to Singapore. But it seems to me Beijing's rationale behind it is that the leadership in Beijing would like to control and silent dissent and won't brook or tolerate any deviation from their rule. So that's what I would like to add to Professor Tong's observations.
Wonderful, thank you. This brings up an interesting, I think, sort of subject that we don't usually, I mean, I think we talk about, we don't focus on the citizens of mainland China. You know, I think about 20 years ago, we had Tiananmen Square protests led by students. It was a fight for democracy. It's similar to what is happening in Hong Kong. How do the people, can you give us a little bit of insight on how citizens in China might view what is happening in Hong Kong and sort of what, you know, the actions they see happening from their government?
Well, we have so many people and people all think differently. So I cannot summarize one single opinion as representing Chinese people. But I, from my understanding or my contact with the Chinese, I think I can somewhat summarize the majority. Well, sort of a lot of people's opinion about what's going on, like in Hong Kong. They don't support it. They don't support the protest in Hong Kong. Well, obviously, probably you can find people that tell you that, yeah, I love Hong Kong. I would support those students in Hong Kong. But I can assure you, these are the minority among the population. Even though that's the Tiananmen protest movement was actually 30 years ago.
Oh, I apologize.
So this now the entire new generation of course, people who experienced the Tiananmen incident is still alive, but well. Time actually do forget a lot of things. So the new generation in China, especially those in the post-90s or even 2000, now the new generations in China, they didn't really have the experiences that their parents experienced. And now they are more confident of China, because China in these years have developing so fast. And the people also travel all over the world, the Chinese, and they feel much more proud of China's achievement in the past 30 years. And that they just felt that just the students in Hong Kong, well, are just making trouble. They are less sympathetic toward students in Hong Kong. That's my understanding. I don't claim to represent the majority of the people in China.
Right, and that was kind of an unfair question. Professor On, anything to add?
Well, I would add that it's very difficult to know exactly the minds of, you know, 1.2, 1.3 billion people. So it's similar disclaimer from my part. But one thing I would like to add is that due to the lack of freedom of information, free flow of information. As you know, there's a firewall and censorship on mainland, unlike Taiwan and Hong Kong. I'm not sure how much the Chinese citizens born after Tiananmen, how much information they can freely access about the Tiananmen incident or massacre of June 4th, 1989. So to answer your question, we have to conduct empirical research, and unfortunately that's not possible.
Wonderful, thank you. I think along these lines, I think we should talk a little bit about, in the past week, I believe Thursday, we saw the Dutch parliament passed a motion to call China's treatment of Uyghur Muslims genocide. And I know that there's been a debate on the world stage about whether or not to call it genocide. This makes the Netherlands the first country in Europe to call it that. And I wonder, what does the U.S. consider when deciding how they would respond to human rights violations that China is taking? Why haven't we seen more of a response from the U.S. And then joining the Netherlands and calling it a genocide?
Go ahead, Professor.
Again, I cannot say I know what's going on in Xinjiang. I think people need to go there and not only to look at the surface and also look inside. And I mean, so I don't think I am really qualified to make comments on what's going on in Xinjiang. But again, just from my own impression, I can say that the criticism or the accusation of genocide probably resonate the least among Chinese people. Unless you are a Uyghur or a member of the Uyghur group, the majority of Chinese people are Han people. I think probably this accusation of genocide, as I said, resonate the least among Chinese people. People will say, hey, their understanding was that these ethnic minorities always enjoy preferential treatment in China. For example, they don't have to follow family planning, to have one kid, one family. And they, when they go to university, they have this affirmative action that favoring minority students. So that's what the Chinese people understand. They say, we treat them very well. How come then suddenly you have this accusation of genocide? And also in the past, there are several incidents that the Uyghur group or Muslim group in China attacked the Han Chinese and actually slaughtered a lot of Chinese. Several incidents in the past, and people just felt that the government need to do something to stop this. So this is my understanding, but I don't know why Holland passed this resolution. And I just think United States should be cautious not to jump in, because I know in the past, the Trump administration used this, even though they didn't have an official policy, but at least they use this word freely, genocide in Xinjiang. I think the new administration should be cautious in doing this.
Why should they? I think it's an interesting, and I think I would agree with you, but why should we be cautious?
If you jump in, it's so hard to watch your mouth. It's hard to pull back.
Yeah.
And just to show, because it's not undisputable thing in what's going on in Xinjiang. And I always doubt, of course, some people will provide some evidence, this and that, but I just remember what happened in 2003 when we claim we have firm evidence that Iraq has the nuclear weapon. And then that led to a war, and that led to how many people died? Not only US soldiers, but Iraqi people. That's disastrous. And based on what evidence? So I just think politicians need to be careful and cautious in issuing this irresponsible labels.
Professor Arden.
I think the term genocide has very far-reaching implications. And if the president of the United States uses or draws on the term genocide, it implies both moral condemnation and I think political action ought to be taken by Congress and definitely the executive branch. Now, let me just speak briefly to the Netherlands declaration. I think the Netherlands, generally speaking, has, and with other Nordic countries, they have been very advanced in and very progressive when it comes to things like global warming, same-sex marriage, things like that. And the Netherlands declaring genocide in Xinjiang province, I think is part of this tradition of waking up the world consciousness, elevating everyone's awareness of the plights of these minorities, which are their religious monuments and buildings are being dismantled based on everything I have seen. And I would recommend simply do an internet search. And there are many fine publications about the situation and the plights of the Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang province.
Thank you. We have about 13 minutes left, and I love the conversation where we're going. I have one question left, and then I want to get to some more of our audience questions. And Professor Tong, you talked a little bit about the rise of hate crimes and xenophobic rhetoric here in the U.S. with COVID. I wonder if we can get into this just a little bit more. Specifically, do you think Biden's actions with China will, how do you think they will affect what happens here domestically in regard to this?
Well, first I have to say, I didn't get any, I didn't suffer from any of this kind of discrimination based on COVID-19 occurrence. Because of course I stayed home all the time. I don't go out very often. So I never felt anything like that, the hate crime thing. But I heard and watched some news from other places in the US that some people were attacked or whatever. I do think this is a result of this rhetoric from President Trump. Just think about this. If I am a small business owner and suddenly because of this COVID-19, I lost customers, I basically lost my business. Suddenly, and I have a family to raise and I am in very desperate situation. And then President Trump says, oh, this Chinese virus, this is communist conspiracy or whatever. And of course I trust the president. And of course I hate the Chinese. Of course, some people are more civilized and they basically keep that to themselves, but some people would like to express their hatred for the cause of their misery. I think that's the situation. If the Biden administration is trying to limit the scale of this use of Chinese virus, they said no, it's not, and just to ask people not to use it. I think this will help, but I don't know to what extent will this reduce the hate crime here in the U.S.
Well, I think the president of the United States can set the moral tone, the high ground, and that the anti-Asian racist incidents that have been reported in mainstream news. Of course, President Biden ought to condemn, and I believe he has condemned these racist incidents. Whether they are hate crimes, I mean, it's difficult to point one's finger without evidence, but based on what I have seen online and all the credible sources that I've looked into, it does seem like the exponential surge of crimes against Asians for no other reasons than that they are Asian Americans have risen and risen dramatically. So I support and applaud President Biden's setting the right moral tone by condemning these heinous crimes.
That was Steve Ahn, Associate Professor of Political Science at the National Sun Yat-sen University. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this final segment, the panel answers questions from the virtual audience. Once more, here is your moderator, Ann Lopez.
Let's get into some of our audience questions. Some of these are very specific. So Naomi asks, how does China's economic investment in East Africa affect the region and China? Yeah, no worries. Okay, so how does China's economic investment in East Africa affect the region and China?
Affect the region and China. Well, China has increased its investment in Asia, no, sorry, in Africa, East Africa. And I think the main purpose is for resources. China wants energy or oil or gas or what, all these, or some mines from Africa. And actually the continent has a lot of that. And but these African countries just on themselves are unable to exploit their rich resources. So China invested there. I think for China, they are aiming at a win-win situation. And China mainly, what China did is to provide aid and actually to build all the infrastructures in Africa, railways or highways, and help to, and the port, and to help African countries to export their resources out. But on the other hand, the African countries will now have highways, railways, or hospitals, and all these instructors there. But of course, some may say that, well, China gained much more. This is exploitation or this is neo-colonialism. But I think because I just heard by an African expert, basically, he believed that African countries also felt that they were also benefit from this Chinese investment. And in comparison with the help from European countries or United States, because their help always have attached certain conditions on the human rights, on the environment, on some other things. So, but Chinese investment just mainly just don't have these conditions or attachment. So they probably would prefer China's money more than the European money. I think this, well, there are of course a lot of issues there, whether or not Chinese investment provide enough employment opportunities for the Africans, maybe not enough. But anyway, so I just think China benefited from its investment in Africa, and also African countries benefited from China's investment there.
Well, let me just add that I would refrain from making too many broad generalizations. I would say it's on a case-by-case basis. So I'm sorry I'm unable to answer the question directly in the sense that Africa, you know, a very large continent with what, 53, 52 nations. So I would have to look at the project, each project and each investment made to that country or that city. But overall, I tend to endorse what Professor Tong just said.
Great, thank you. Let's just end with this last question. I think it's a great question. Preston asks, what role, if any, do private actors in the US, such as organizations like the NBA, play in US-China relations?
Yeah, I am an NBA fan. I watch Jazz all the time. Well, of course, we all know what happened a year and a half ago when the manager of Houston Rocket made a political comment on Hong Kong situation, and then China shut up all the NBA activities in China. But I think it is resuming now, probably the All-Star game, which will be this weekend, that will be shown on Chinese central TV. I think this is very important, the role like NBA in China, because I am a fan, so I watch all these websites, discussion forums on NBA basketball. I think there are a huge number of NBA fans. And they, I think NBA played, they were so frustrated by the sanctions against the NBA, but it doesn't mean they don't support their government doing so, but they were so frustrated that they couldn't watch NBA games. So they were so happy that China is resuming broadcasting the NBA games. And because of NBA, I think these young fans, and because all the fans are tends to be young, have very, friendly attitude toward American athletes or players. I think that is a good thing for the relations between two countries, but not on the political level, but on the social level.
Well, let me just add that we need to make a very basic distinction between the elites or policymakers and what we might call the general mass or innocent civilians, the ordinary people. One-on-one interactions between so-called average Americans and average Chinese citizens, of course, that will definitely engender and create a mutual further mutual understandings and mutual goodwills from each side. Whether these citizen to citizen or peer to peer relations translate to political decisions at the governmental level, that is difficult to say, but of course, I wholly endorse and encourage more citizen to citizen visits and communications. So those are my comments.
Perfect. Awesome. Okay, we have a minute left. I just want each of you to take like 20 to 30 seconds just to sum up what we've talked about, or what would be your last, what is the last thing you would say in regard to US China relations? Just to sum everything up.
Yeah. Well, just hope for the best. I do hope that the two countries' relations get back to more friendly situation instead of seeing each other as the enemy. Just this is wishful thinking, probably from my personal perspective. I would like to see more cooperation between the two countries. And that's, again, it's about win-win situation. And also like to deal, like the situation of this pandemic crisis, two countries need to cooperate with each other and just to get over this public health crisis.
Well, I would say that our political difference, our ideological difference aside, citizens from China, tracing all the way back to the Qing Dynasty before the creation of the United States, have contributed greatly to the well-being and the development of the United States. So I hope, just as Professor Tong just expressed a moment ago, that a greater cooperation and greater understanding from both the US and China and Chinese citizens around the world could be, further progress could be made on this front. And we don't want to see innocent civilians and their lives destroyed over political misunderstanding or ideological conflict. That would be my final statement.
That's our show. If you'd like to hear our other local programming, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.